I'm here today with Michael Rizzo and Ethan Cox about Buffalo beer, the history of brewing in the Nickel City, from the days when a beer could cost a nickel, right?
True, yes.
What happened?
Times happened, prohibition happened, a lot of things, including, you know, families got to a point where, next generations didn't necessarily want it. There was consolidation. And really, in the end, it was the big breweries that were able to come in and sell their beer below cost so they could price the local guys out of business.
Ethan, you brew beer here now. What was different about beer in Buffalo, 150 years ago?
You know, I think the best answer to that is less than you think. One of the things that was cool in doing the research for this book was finding out, especially through, you know, the old bottles and labels, which is where you really learn this information. But these breweries were making a lot more than just standard light German lagers. Although all these breweries were mostly run by Germans, and they were certainly making those beers, they were making Dunkelweisses. They were making Bock beers. All of them made a Bock beer, kind of a seasonal thing. Some of them made sour wheat beers like Berliner Weiss. It was a crazy thing to see that in the record of the bottles. So, yeah, I think a good answer is less than you think in the sense that there was a lot of diversity.
Mike makes a point in the book in a couple of different situations of American-born members of these brewing families who were sent back to Bavaria or wherever to learn how to do it, I suppose, the old-fashioned way, right?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of them would go back, study, and then come back. Sometimes they would go work at in another city at a brewery and back in Buffalo, and that's where they would, a lot of times they'd open their own breweries or go to work for family.
Was it because there were so many German immigrants here, or was it the water and the grain, or what made Buffalo such a brewing center?
I think the Germans are really what started. It was just a lot of them, it was their background. So they came here with that knowledge. Some of them had brewing history. So they would come here and, they'd need to start a business, and that's what they would do. But eventually, all those other factors came into play, too.
The European tradition, or claim anyway, is that beer became such a big thing across the board, the monasteries or wherever, because you couldn't trust the drinking water. Was that a problem here?
I don't think it was a problem until the lake became polluted. You know, up until that time, I think that's pretty much all they used was a lake or spring water. That was a big thing. There was spring water that they used. But until that time...
In Cold Spring.
Exactly. Yep. Until that time, I don't think there was a problem.
Ethan, when you look at the ingredients, I mean, it says rice or grain or hops. How different were those individual ingredients?
They were different, certainly. And so when people find old recipes or want to replicate, or beers of yore or whatever, you're well served to keep in mind that indeed the different hop varieties that are available today for the most part weren't available back then and vice versa. Same with different kinds of barleys and different malting processes. So to get the flavor of yesteryear, you'd have to also find some, wild growing, perhaps old varieties of hops. And if they've gone wild, then they've probably changed in some way, too. So it's impossible to really know what the beers tasted like. We can only know how they described them in terms of styles. People didn't really sit around and write reviews of beer at the time either. It was taken as a drink that you drank, and you didn't sit around talking about it while you drank it much, other than to say, good beer. So unfortunately, there's not much we can say with definitively about what it used to taste like. But I bet it was tasty.
Well, have you been to breweries in Europe?
Yeah.
Okay, how much can they tell you about this same brewery brewed something 300 years ago?
Yeah, correct. I think for the most part, the innovation of craft beer, culture is sort of an American thing. And so if you go to Germany or Belgium, Holland, you will find some people who are producing beer in much the same way that they have for 300-400 years. So that's certainly a good way to think about a window into the past flavor profiles of beers, absolutely.
So if someone came from Bavaria in just before the Civil War, what they would have been used to was whatever beers were brewed in Bavaria just before the American Civil War.
Absolutely, and they wouldn't have thought of those beers either in terms of really specific styles in the way we do now. It was just the beer that they grew up with, the beer of the region, the beer that they knew. You wouldn't walk into a bar in Bavaria 150 years ago and find them with a wide selection of different German beers and some American beers thrown on for good measure, right? It would have just been what they made in the area.
Mike, you make a point in the book that the American, or at least the Buffalo brewers anyway, did the same thing that, for example, you see in England where you have tied bars where the, you know, they own 100 bars around town that are pushing out Courage beer or whatever it is. How much did that have to do with the way the brewery industry developed here pre-Prohibition?
Right. That was a big deal because a lot of them could control their beer where it was sold. So they would own property. A lot of times it was taverns, but they did buy huge, you know, acres of property all over the area, and I think they traded it. But the breweries, by controlling the number of taverns, sometimes they would go in and they'd buy a competitor's property. Next thing you know, now their beer is served in another location, and that's just the way they did it.
Looking at the book, there seems to be a history of dozens of small breweries. I mean, you look at some of the addresses that you mentioned where there were breweries. I mean, the buildings that are sitting on that site now don't really look like breweries, and they look old.
Yeah. There were, when, you know, it's funny, it's oft quoted by people who, well, now I guess they'll quote our book, but if you were familiar with Stephen Powell's Rushing the Growler, you know, I've heard from people before, like, did you know Buffalo used to have like 37 breweries? I'm like, I did. But what they're forgetting is that, yeah, the vast majority of them were quite small. Maybe they were cranking out 500 or 1,000 barrels a year, not a lot. Most of it was probably drunk right there. They were tavern breweries. They weren't, you know, production breweries sending product out into the market very far. The ones that really survived and the ones that made a name for themselves and the ones that you can find, you know, the relics of are the ones that got beyond that point. Absolutely.
Well, for comparison, how many barrels a year are you brewing?
There you go. We're going to produce, we produced about a little over 500 barrels last year.
So there were breweries here in the old days that produced less, and over time there were breweries that produced a whole lot more.
Considerably more. By the end of their runs, you know, breweries like Simon Pure and Iroquois, we're making 40, 50, you know, even maybe 100,000 barrels a year. So they were doing pretty well, although not as well as the larger national concerns that, you know, had the ability to put them out of business.
Well, how much of the nature of beer in those early days, in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, reflected the guy who was sitting in back mixing the beer and mixing the ingredients, and how much of it was more standardized? Mike?
Well, I think that I think most of those breweries, they all started out that way. A lot of them were just in their back room or in the, you know, their barn. A lot of them started out that way. And I think for the most part, the majority, because we counted at least 140 breweries over time. And I would say that at least three quarters, if not more than that, were those type of breweries. They were just, you know, one guy, sometimes a couple people, maybe their kids, but they never, some of them didn't barely make a blip on the map.
How much of this involved standardized brewing equipment, or did everybody just call the guy who in the summer built boilers for ships and the winter built machinery?
You know, that's a great follow-on, because I think the difference between the breweries that grew and the breweries that didn't, the other story that we're telling here is the story of industrialization, albeit of a particular industry. And so the breweries that we document that opened at the earliest time in the 1830s and 40s, you know, yeah, those were, you know, very much artisanal, hand-crafted kind of affairs, and the size of them reflected that. And probably the quality and consistency of their beer also reflected that.
Well, when they started, I can't believe you could ship beer very far from a brewery at Main and Goodell.
No. Beer is a low enough alcohol product that it absolutely goes bad. And I'm sure, you know, freshness was a very important factor. And the packaging that they had at the time wasn't like what we have in terms of modern packaging, in terms of bottles and sealing the tops and cans and whatever else. So you bet the beer needed to be drunk pretty quickly.
I mean, you didn't want to put it on a barge going down the Erie Canal.
No, and wherever you ended up, they would have had a bunch of their own breweries anyway.
Yeah, it did get, well, like Albert Ziegel. I mean, he did throw his on wagons and get it down to Dunkirk in the middle of winter. So, I mean, they did distribute it some distances.
Is that before the cooks or after?
Before.
Just, you know, I mean, that's a local beer name that people would recognize, oh, yeah, even though the latest Cook is in business and doing it in Boston.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, Cook's is an interesting brewery because at the end of all of our kind of local native breweries' runs, they end up with the label rights to all of them. So Cook's produces the last bottles of Simon Pure and Iroquois that anybody ever bought, and that's all the way up into the early 80s, which is amazing to me. I could have had fresh Simon Pure.
One thing that I found interesting, I would have assumed that these breweries would be along the lake, along the Buffalo River, along the canal, and most of them were inland.
Yeah, they definitely were. And for the most part, a lot of them were in the German-dominated neighborhoods. A couple of them built outside of that, on the east side, in the Polish neighborhood, on the west side. And that one was right on the Erie Canal. But for the most part, a lot of them were inland in the German neighborhoods. Just that's where they built. That's where a lot of them lived. So it was their neighborhood.
So I have this image of giant fleets of horses and wagons trotting all day, every day, carrying malt and beer and whatever all over town and in the mud and whatever of the streets.
I bet that's entirely accurate. I've been told that the size of the Colonel Ward pumping station was partly predicated on the needs of Buffalo's brewing industry, and that it's actually, to this day, only running at about half capacity.
Well, beer, did people know some of the risk? You mentioned Pasteur in the book and pasteurization, but you also have a couple of references to bad beer. I mean, were people getting sick, or were they just saying, this stuff isn't worth drinking?
I'm sure there were times, based on whatever happened to the beer, that there were times when bad beer did come about. Didn't come across a lot of that, but definitely pasteurization helped to change that.
Certainly, judging by some of the data in the book, these breweries appeared and disappeared pretty fast sometimes.
Yeah, some of them were around for sometimes months. Sometimes you could find them for a year or two. And sometimes those people would go on to work at another brewery, or they would merge breweries. There was a lot of that where people were partnering and they'd break off, or they'd go to work for another one, or they would just, pass away and then their brewery was gone.
Ethan, how good is it for a brewery if you have a lot of local competition?
Up to a point, certainly, it's healthy. Up to a point, I think, we help one another because we're still in a market and we're still in a situation where the vast majority of beer drinkers are enjoying the products of, large international conglomerized corporations and so, Budweiser, Molson, whatever, all that stuff. So I think the craft brewing industry, such as it is, still finds a lot of value in sort of clinging together. Not just because it's fun. We like to hang out and drink one another's beers, and that's one reason that we tend to get along with one another as opposed to other industries where it's more cutthroat. But I think we also recognize that we're still, the David fighting the Goliath, and so we also need kind of one another to help raise consciousness for everybody.
Well, it seemed to me reading the book that one of the things that in some ways hurt the beer industry is it stayed in this German-American group, maybe born here or second generation or whatever, but it doesn't seem to have broadened out much beyond this core group of Germans.
No, yeah, you're right. And that was a big thing. I mean, these people were extremely influential in the city, in politics, in business, and it did not go very far past that. There were a few people that were non-Germans, but they did not survive. They weren't. One thing, like Ethan points out, is that they doesn't appear they were allowed to join like the Brewers Association if they weren't German. So that probably helped to keep people out of the industry that weren't German.
Does it reflect just the ethnic makeup here until the early part of the 20th century when we had large Polish and Italian immigration?
Well, keep in mind as well, these guys, first of all, as they were kind of growing some of the first industrialized, food making out there, they were also making a lot of money. And you see that reflected when you go see their graves in either Forest Lawn or the German-American Cemetery, where most of them are buried. They tend to have pretty nice monuments. They were influential in politics. They were influential in banking and local commerce more broadly. And so like any immigrant group, you know, when the next wave starts to come in, they want to hold on to what they got. And so there was a lot of, you know, there was a, the German culture was very vibrant here. And we don't remember that, I guess, but we had a whole bunch of German newspapers. We had all these guys were members of the same clubs, German singing clubs and German cultural clubs. The German-American brewery itself had a rooftop beer garden at the corner of High and Main that must have had an incredible view of the city. And from there, I guarantee you...
Doesn't the book say it was 12 stories high?
Yeah, and I guarantee you a lot of wheeling and dealing. It was like the golf course of its day, I guess. It's probably where the power brokers went to figure out who was going to do what.
Mike, you've done a number of local books. Where did you find the material for this one?
There are many old history books, and we were able to gather all those books and the history in there. And there's not a lot of history on Buffalo breweries, but take that along with the newspapers and thousands of pages of census data that I went through, just trying to track where people were and where they lived, and able to take all those different sources and put it together.
Obituaries, too.
I noticed that. And judging by the bibliography, a lot of research in the newspapers here.
Yeah.
Although the Buffalo News doesn't seem to have covered as much of it as the Courier did.
Yeah, the Couriers were very good, and predecessors to those, too. But, yeah, they used to, again, because these people were very important in the community a lot of times, and news, there was less news at the time, so they would print almost anything.
Do people come to you and say, gee, you know, somebody told me my great-grandfather was a brewer in Buffalo.
Yeah.
What do you tell them about how to find out?
Yeah, I've come across that in a lot of things that I've written. Somebody has some tie to history. First of all, I'll go to my index and see if they're in there. That's always a good place to start. But again, if they were somebody, there's always online, especially the census records. That's always a great place to start.
When you finish a book like that, what do you do with your archives?
I just box it. I have boxes and boxes of archives.
I mean, you don't give them to the Historical Society or something like that?
No, it's usually not. It's not that extensive. A lot of stuff I keep on my computer, so I don't have tons of it to give away.
Ethan, do people come to you and ask, gee, somebody told me that this was a great beer city once upon a time?
Sure. I'm always happy to explain our pretty awesome beer history past to people because I think it's pretty cool. I know it's not entirely unique. I know that Philly and New York City and Cincinnati also had German populations that grew breweries, and a lot of those breweries also didn't end up becoming household names, and so similar stories. But I do think ours has a unique dimension in the malting side. I know that the malting industry here was giant, and it was probably fueling the brewing industry of other cities. But I love those names. I love Iroquois. I love Simon Pure. I remember these names and old Brewery Anna kind of hovering in the background of my youth and in people's garages and basement bars and whatever else. And it to me, it's a real connection with the city, so much so that when I moved back here in 2006, I got the Simon Pure logo tattooed on my back. So I'm into it.
That sounds... Well, I suppose George Shultz was Secretary of State and had a Princeton Tiger tattooed on a portion of his anatomy. Okay. But is this what you're just mentioning? Is that different? I mean, I remember when I was a kid, Ballantyne sponsored the Yankee games on the radio, and you had the Miss Rheingold competition in the New York subway. Mm-hmm. Was this pretty common across the country, at least where there were German roots?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, there was definitely – they always – sponsored the breweries themselves sponsored everything from you know sports teams to radio shows to later on to television shows, so they were involved in all kinds of things. It's good advertising.
Can't do that anymore.
That's true.
We've been talking to Mike Rizzo and Ethan Cox about their new book Buffalo Beer: The History of Brewing in the Nickel City. I'm Mike Desmond, WBFO News.